Hi, this is Neil Monens from WineReleased.com. We're here doing a podcast with Victor Gallegos and also Randall Dennis. Victor is the general manager of Sea Smoke and also the winemaker and owner of Melis
in the Prerot
region.
But I'm the general manager and the dirt farmer at Sea Smoke.
So we just took a little tour, and now we're doing a little tasting of Sea Smoke. So
we're in the ghetto.
Victor, good afternoon. Okay, so Sea Smoke plants in 99.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you were fortunate in getting your first bottle then 3 years after that in 01.
Yeah, 01 was the first vintage, very small, and there was some question about whether we were going to bring it to market or not. At the end of the day, we decided to, and luckily was well received.
How was it received? Meaning, did you actually take any awards or get traditional high scores on that year?
We were lucky to make it into the top 100 from the Wine Spectator with our first vintage, which was really lucky. And it was actually, in large part, thanks to Doug Marjoram at the Wine Cask. I don't know if you guys are around for the weekend. Doug does a thing every year called the Santa Barbara Futures Tasting. Really a pioneer in a sense of going around and finding the small guys producing cool little wines in Santa Barbara County, even before Santa Rita Hills was really known as an AVA. And writing those up and doing not a true futures program, but sort of a variation on the futures theme. Jim Lowby from The Spectator got wind of it and said, "Hey, Doug, why don't you send up to me the things that you think I should taste?
Your standouts."
Yeah, your standouts. And so Doug did that. We didn't really even know that was going to happen, and it happened. And then all of a sudden, Jim really liked our wines and came down here, and we got included in the top 100, and the wine scored well with Parker as well. So we got very lucky sort of very early on in our development.
How unusual is it to be able to produce wine, especially good wine, at Third Leaf? Meaning, what's normal? How many years?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, and having come from the Prerot, I can say that I was very bought into the old vine mythology. Mm-hmm. And still to some degree am, but having been involved in winemaking there now for several years, and telling you that I sought out at great expense and great pain vineyards from 60 to 120 years old to add to our fruit from our estate vineyard, which was younger, because I believed that old vine mythology. I thought you couldn't do what we have done at Third or Fourth Leaf, that it was just physically impossible, and so it was somewhat of a surprise. I think the reason for that is, to take a sort of very technical view of it, is that old vines are self-regulating. They self-regulate in terms of yield, because yield declines as you move on. Traditionally, people didn't spend a lot of time doing crop reduction or vine balance with young vineyards, and so they tended to overproduce, and the wine that you got from them was not very interesting. Now, you're certainly not going to get the complexity that you will get from an older vineyard, but I think you can make outstanding wines, and both Sea Smoke and the project in Spain, Melis, have shown me that you can actually make really outstanding wines early on in a vineyard's life if you're very careful about vine balance,
mm-hmm.
and bringing a vineyard, young vineyard along very, very slowly. Most people don't have the economic wherewithal to make the hard decisions to do that. So that's why it doesn't often get done. But if you do, I think you can make really pretty wines. Certainly they'll get better, and our wines have gotten better just as a function of the vineyard gaining age and complexity.
When you talk about dropping fruit, how much per acre does Sea Smoke bring in?
Per acre is a nice sort of first approximation. I would urge people to look beyond per acre and look, if you really want to look down a winemaker or vineyard manager's underwear, you should talk about pounds per vine, because
okay.
It really comes down to vine yield, vine balance and the yield on a per vine basis. And you can look at a vineyard that's at 1.5 tons per acre, and it may be overcropped based on what the vine is capable of handling in terms of its vigorousness and its sturdiness, what kind of soil it's grown on. So in the Prerot, 800 grams of vine is all you're ever going to get. Yeah. Wow. Okay. That sounds amazing. And often you can be overcropped at that because you're on rock.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the vine is really struggling, even then. I try and shy away from. But to answer your question directly, we will max out at 2.6 tons an acre, 2.67 tons per acre. You'll talk to cab guys in Napa who say they're radically undercropped at at 4 pounds per vine, we'll max out at 3 pounds a vine. So I don't know what that means at the end of the day, and I don't really care.
Well, it gives me a feel percentage-wise, though, of how much fruit you're dropping.
Yeah. I can, for example, in 2003, we dropped 60% of the crop on the ground. That was $1.5 million decision. And it was only done because we had really uneven flowering and fruit set, and it was what we needed to do to maintain quality. Mm-hmm. So whatever happens in a given year happens. You know, it's farming.
That's right.
And we don't have a business plan that says, oh, we must produce X cases in 05 to meet our plan. Certainly, it's a business, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is producing great Pinot Noir. 06 is 20% smaller than 05. Just the way it goes.
Does that mean prices are going to be 20% higher?
No, not at all. We've held prices. So.
Right. Talked earlier about farming to the vine level, and then in the
farming at the or making wine at the barrel level.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's when you get really fastidious about this business, ultimately you have to be looking at the vine level. We're, you know, we talked about how we touch 157,000 vines 7 or 8 times individually during the growing season. That's by a human being, excluding things that are quasi-mechanical, like hedging or applying netting. That means that your vineyard crew, that intellectual capital, is incredibly valuable because they're given the ability to make decisions on the spot that are going to affect quality in a very real way. Best example is vine balance that we were talking about. You can say, okay, overall we want X pounds per vine this vintage, but every vine has its theme or its story. You saw replants in there because gophers are the bane of our existence, right? Well, a standard, okay, every vine's going to get 15 clusters or 20 clusters and they weigh 0.15 pounds per cluster. Well, you have to modify that when you come across a vine that's not capable of handling that to achieve vine balance on every vine that you're dealing with. So that's farming at the vine level, is every vine is assessed in and of itself by your vineyard crew.
It's done at the end of each season when you're pruning back, and then during each growing season.
Yeah, it's more during the growing season because, to some degree, also during pruning, for sure, but really where a lot of that vine-by-vine assessment takes place is during those hand operations mid-season, particularly at post-foraging when we're doing green drop to adjust crop levels and deciding which lovely little clusters we're leaving and which ones we're dumping on the ground. You know, those decisions are significant.
How about irrigation?
Yeah, so we talked about all the pain, you know, to find the right site, the clay soils, all the blah,
sure.
blah, 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 this amazing piece of dirt.
South-facing versus north.
And you can ruin all that in a heartbeat with water. That's like that's the Achilles heel of all farming, really, and more so with grape growing. So we use a system, like many people use with soil probes, which is a standard thing, but that's using soil probes gives you an idea of the plant's external environment. It's much like saying you and I, Randall, are going to go running in the desert and somebody tells us it's 120 degrees outside and you're fine for 3 miles and I die after a quarter mile because individually we've responded differently to our external environment.
I'd be surprised if I made it 3 miles, but I understand the analogy.
I have faith in you. Likewise, a great vine or vine in general, but a grapevine is going to respond to that soil water environment differently, one grape, one plant to another. So what we do is use a system, which many people use, called pressure bomb, which measures vine water stress or vine water status, but usually stress. And what we want is to maintain the stress level on those vines within a certain band. The idea, it's a horrible analogy, but imagine a woman in sub-Saharan Africa who has limited resources and has to decide whether she focuses those resources towards her children or towards herself, or that her children at her own detriment. And mm-hmm. so she's going to choose the children, the next generation. Well, in this case, the vine's next generation is the seed, encapsulated, as it turns out, by the grape. So what we want is the vine to turn its attention away from vegetative growth to focusing on the clusters.
Itself.
Right? It's next generation. And so by keeping it in a stressed environment, it's saying, I wonder if I'm going to survive. I better really focus, rather than growing more leaf, what's going to propagate me for the future. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to focus on the grapes. And so we have, depending upon the block and the soil and the rootstock, we have bands of stress that we want to maintain the vine within. So there's a guy whose full-time job it is between 11:30 and 1 every day in a little ATV and a little suitcase that's aluminum with a chamber in the middle and a lid with a rubber aperture. He runs around 25 blocks, 10 measurements per block twice a week, 500 and something measurements. And he takes a...
He gets paid to drive around on a four-wheeler.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yes.
I know. I want that job. And he takes a leaf, and he puts the stem through that rubber aperture, puts the leaf in a baggie, dials that down into the chamber, floods that chamber with nitrogen, and reads the pressure up to the point where the fluid, the liquid in the leaf, is pushed through the vascular tissue, out the leaf petiole. Once he sees it coming out and forming a little bubble, he turns the gas off and reads the pressure in bars. Well, that pressure in bars required to push the water through the vascular tissue and out of the leaf is inversely proportional to the tension the plant was exerting at that moment to pull water out of the soil.
Extract water. That's interesting.
So it's giving you vine water stress, right? And so then the trick is to water just enough to bring the vine water stress to the bottom of that band and no more, so that you're always keeping it stressed out but not reaching permanent wilting point for the plant. So very complex. We talk about
even though we didn't see them, you're not dry farming these. There was irrigation down the road.
But
we just
what does dry farming mean, really? I mean, people talk about being dry farmed. It could be that they've got water 3 feet down that lasts until September, and they're dry farmed. Their water stress level could be nothing.
Right. And there's no way to actually monitor that.
Look at Bordeaux. I mean, I farmed in Bordeaux. You know, the Gironde is right there. And you dig down not very far and you find water. Well, luckily the French have figured out over several centuries that it runs out just at the right time during the year. But they've got this, it would be very interesting to look at water stress levels throughout the season there where your water table is pretty high, mm-hmm. and see the difference. So again, that's one of those old things, dry farming is better. Well, it certainly was when you were planting on alluvial fans or riparian habitat where your water was pretty close by. But when you're farming on 35-40% slopes with zero topsoil or limited topsoil, you don't have a whole lot of water holding capacity in the soil to begin with, so you might as well be, you're in effect, dry farmed.
Okay. Tell us about the three different Pinots that you make.
And also how you come up with the names, too.
Well, sea smoke is a definition of fog. So that name was thought of by Bob Davids and his family. Bob Davids, the owner of Sea Smoke, locked his family into a hotel room for a day and would not let them leave until they came up with the name. And I think it was his daughter, Poppy, who actually said, well, hey, guess what? You know, the seventh definition in Webster's is for fog is sea smoke. And so the name stuck. And
it's perfect.
It's perfect for the region, absolutely. And then the idea was to make three different styles of wine out of the vineyard. Because we have, as you've seen, 25 blocks of variety of exposures and slopes and soil types, and 10 clones, 3-4 rootstocks, 5 different soil types, and unlimited exposure variation. So there's a lot of palette there to work with. It's gotten us into some trouble because nobody really understands what in the world Botella, Sauvignon, or 10 mean, and I sympathize with them. But it was just a way of taking physical aspects of the property and applying those as names to the different styles of wine coming off our vineyard. So Botella is a clay soil that's found in that lower section of the vineyard, about 37 acres. And Sauvignon refers to all the south-facing slopes. It's actually a nautical term, which means making way southward. So it's somewhat of a misnomer. We hope the hills aren't moving, but they're all south-facing. And then 10 refers to all 10 clones. So originally it was our quote-unquote favorite barrel lots of each of those 10 clones. I'm not sure that it's necessarily our favorite barrel lots of each of those 10 clones, but it's the barrels that exhibit 10-ness within what we do.
And describe the characteristics of each wine.
Batella is intended to be light, fruit forward, easily drinkable. You can sip that all day. It's a sipping wine. People who love white wine always love it. And it's a great example within the Santa Rita Hills of a light, somewhat feminine style of wine. Again, within a Santa Rita Hills context, it's not Russian River Pinot. And then Southing is intended to be complexity with elegance, sort of the closest we get as California or our appellation to a classically styled Pinot Noir. And I hesitate to say that, but at least it gives you a frame of reference. And then 10 is powerful and robust. Some would say high testosterone. And it's, in my opinion, not something you necessarily want to stand around and sip, but it's a wonderful food wine. Mm-hmm. Those are the three. And you're drinking 05 Batella, in case I didn't tell you that, which was bottled about 10 days ago.
Okay. And you said you use exclusively French oak. All of your Pinot sees oak. And then how long typically in the barrel and how long in the bottle before it gets released?
We're about 15 to 18 months in barrel, depending upon when we harvest and when we bottle. Mm-hmm. There's not a set definition of how long it needs to stay in barrel. It's loosey-goosey. And we'll bottle when it's ready to bottle and when our bottling line doesn't break down. So
right. Number one complaint I hear about bottling wines.
Yeah, exactly. Generally speaking, about 15 to 16 months in oak, and exclusively, obviously, French oak. Thought about experimenting with other things, but we keep coming back to kind of what works well. And we've had enough experiments going on just with the coopers, let alone, mm-hmm. you know, sources of oak. So we use about 12 different coopers. Chris and Don do a really good job, Chris Curran, our winemaker, and Don Schroeder, our assistant winemaker, of kind of, and we dialed this in over time, and I think our wines have gotten better as a result of it, is starting to pair coopers with clones and cooper, as we've learned coopers more and more, pairing sort of heavy-hitting and more aggressive coopers with wines that can stand up to it. So no individual wine in any barrel is out of balance. There's less fixing you have to do down the road.
Mm-hmm. Chris's background, where was she prior to coming to Sea Smoke?
She was originally at Cambria. She was at Cambria for a number of years, and then went to start Kohler, which is another winery in San mm-hmm. Ynez Valley. She's actually from San Ynez Valley, so she's a local girl.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Then when she was at Kohler, and Bob had already basically planted this vineyard, when Bob Davids came to the Santa Rita Hills, he had looked a variety of places in the world to plant Pinot Noir. And he came to this area, and Bill Wathen from Foxen helped him find the site for Sea Smoke. Part of that process, he had talked to Bruno D'Alfonso from Stanford as well, because Bruno and Billy are old colleagues from the Chalon days. When Bob was looking for a winemaker, Bruno said, well, hey, you might want to talk to Chris. Chris has been Bruno's significant other for 14 years or something now. And Chris saw, I think to her credit, kind of the opportunity and the site, and said, yeah, I'm on board.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, what a home run for her then.
Yeah, she's done a fantastic job.
Let's talk a little bit about Prerot, your project there, and how long has it been going on?
It's been going on too long. Oddly, the first time I went to Prerot with my partner, Javier, who was my roommate at Davis, he's not an enologist, but he was an ag econ guy, but our first trip there was 85, just when sort of the modern renaissance was beginning with José Luis Pérez and Alfredo Palacios and René Barbier. And his father had been asked to invest there, Javier, my partner's father, and his father said, called me. I was doing an internship in Bordeaux at the time, and he said, hey, I don't know what I'm looking at. Will you come and check this place out? And we did, and we turned around for a couple of days, and, you know, the vines in Towa was amazing. The wines were horrific. And I said, you know, this is going to take a generation. I wouldn't put a dime in here. But I've been reminded of that every year now, of that advice that I gave at the tender age of whatever it was, 22 or 23. And so Javi and I looked at each other and said, well, you know, this would be really cool if we had any money at some point to come back here and do something. Mm-hmm. And so we were going back and forth every couple of years. He would come stay with me for the summer. I'd go over there. And in 99, we went back and toured Priorat again, and things had just changed. You know, Jose Luis Perez was, who's Sims de Porrera and Claude Martinet, Mas Martinet, was Javier's biology professor in high school. So this old association, he said, "You guys, I'll tour you around." And we were just blown away. And we said, "Well, we still don't have the money, but we need to do something now or it's never going to happen." And so we, with Jose Luis's help, we looked. I had some very specific things that I was looking for in a vineyard site. And so we laid those out for him, and we looked. He helped us look for about a year. And we finally found sort of seven contiguous parcels, south-facing, access to the Garbinada, Licoreya soils, the whole nine yards. And it had some 60-year-old Carignana and then plantable acreage. And so we planted about another, well, we've got 20 acres now planted total, high-density double-row terraces and everything. And, you know, we talked about earlier about the old vine fruit thing, and so I was convinced that we needed, you know, I didn't want to make a super Tuscan version of Priorat. I'm excited by local varieties and honoring kind of local tradition in winemaking, at least in terms of varieties. And so it had to be Garnacha and Carignana dominant, and preferably old vine Garnacha, at least so I thought. And so we went out and signed up three or four other vineyards in Torroja and Porrera under long-term contract, fixed price. We just said, here's, you know, so that we can control farming. Mm-hmm. And in most of those cases, we have options to buy. And we said, great, we're locked and loaded, and we did it. And every year it's turned out that although we like the lots that are from, you know, these 120-year-old vines, which are very cool things, we still like the stuff of our state best. Which was a complete surprise. I did not expect that to happen.
So tell me again what your degree was at Davis.
I was a viticulturalist, but I was lucky because...
So as such, I mean, that, like, vineyard management is more the focus there than as opposed to...
Well, I got Dr. Kunke at the time to let me take all the upper division enology classes without the prereqs. He said, if you can survive it, great. So I did. But I wasn't going to stick around for another year and finish my prereqs to get an enology degree as well.
The reason why I ask then is, as a viticulturalist, then you indeed have the background to actually, when you're doing your new plantings, to source your root stock and your clone varietals and to pair those up with the soil and know what's going to work where.
Yeah, yes. But I have to say it's been a little bit humbling being there. I mean, I've learned to really respect the old timers. I mean, it's odd, but they've saved me a lot of money and a lot of sweat. You know, they know the weather patterns. They know what you can and can't do. And the you know, Licoreya soils are slate. They're rock. There are no mechanical implements you can use there that won't break within the first day. You know, it's just their insight has been invaluable. So yes, I mean, you can come in there with all the knowledge in the world and to your own detriment sometimes. So I've learned to kind of respect their knowledge. And whether or not they understand the reasons for something, it doesn't really matter. You know, they have that knowledge that's passed on, and we ignore it at our peril. So yeah, it's been humbling.
So what's the case production now? What is your goal?
The first vintage was just under 1,000 cases, which was the 04, which is in the market right now, which we've been very lucky with. And 05 will be released in April, mid-April. We have actually two wines, Melisse and a wine called Elix, which is kind of the wines that don't make it stylistically into the first wine. And it, so it ends up being Carignana and Cabernet-based. It all sold out immediately in Germany and Switzerland last year, so we didn't have any to bring to the U.S., but we'll bring it here this year. We're very excited about that. It's about half the price of Melisse.
Yeah, because your Melisse is about 75?
It's 75 euros
in
there, which makes it about 90 bucks here because of exchange rate and everything, which is, you know, pricey. Mm-hmm. And Elix will be about 42 or 44 or something, depending on where you are in the country.
Distribution do you want in what countries, and how much is it going to make it back here to U.S.?
Well, we're about 2,000 cases of those together. and they're about 50-50 in volume. I would say 60% of our distribution is outside the U.S. Ideally, I would like to see us about 50-50 between U.S. And ex-U.S. I think we have the vineyards at this point that we want, including our estate, and I think we'll top out at around 4,000, which is fine. That's plenty. Otherwise, I can't keep my day job. Because I'm using vacation from Sea Smoke to go make wine and bottle and everything in Spain.
So how much time do you spend over there?
How long are you over there?
Well, I'm there for about a month at harvest, obviously, because that's the key winemaking time of the year. And, I mean, we have a great team. I've got an enologist, Tony Sanchez, and my partner Javier is there kind of running day-to-day stuff. And then we have Claude Gross as our consulting enologist from Languedoc. He makes Châtelain, Negli, and some other really kick-ass wines. He's just amazing.
What month is harvest over there usually?
Well, we would hope it's October usually.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
Pinot's early, so
September.
The
we'll
best
pull here.
Scenario is we have everything picked here. I turn things over to Chris, and
my work here is done.
My work here is
change
done.
Change the cape and fly over
and
there.
Fly over there, precisely.
All right.
And then I got to go back for bottling, which I'm doing actually Monday. I leave for bottling for about 10 days. And then I try and make it over one other time during the year for a week or two when I can. Javi and I have a winery project going. We're building a winery right now in Tarroja. So it's kind of a winery museum and 12 apartments, kind of an agritourism thing. So
how fun.
Yeah, it's cool. So
that's right up your alley.
That's another. Yeah, and it's odd because, I mean, tourists are flocking. You know, these are the Priorat's nine little hill towns. With 200 people each.
How are you spelling that, by the way? Because that's an odd pronunciation.
Well, Priorato is in Castilian. Priorato. P-R-I-O-R-A-T-O. But in Catalan, it's Priorat.
Okay. Just, I think, for people listening, it may...
Yeah. Which is priory.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's been cool. And, you know, the reality is you don't know. You do try. You think you've done everything right. You've made every decision correctly all along that pathway to get where you need to be. And you don't know until it's in the bottle.
So what's the goal, I mean, for you personally? I mean, if that project continues to become more and more time-demanding and successful,
yeah.
Do you take your wife and relocate over there?
I mean, no, my life is actually here.
Yeah.
You know, we have a life here. We have horses. We have, you know, things that I like Spain very much. I could not live full-time in the Priorat.
Mm-hmm.
I love it the time, and I love it more every year, but I wouldn't want to spend 100% of my time there. Nor, to be honest, would I want to spend 100% of my time here. I'm very happy being by Atlantic.
Yeah, I don't.
No, well, that answer is on the record, right?
And Bob has asked me the same question.
Well,
because
he's got to see it coming, and he needs to know if there's...
So what's the next step for Victor Gallegos?
All of us that are here at Sea Smoke recognize how friggin' lucky we really are. I mean, this is an amazing place to be, and it's an amazing piece of soil. And we're going to stay here as long as Bob will let us stay here. The Spain at 4,000 cases is a great little business, but it's not going to allow me to quit my day job, so that will stay. And the reality is I have life in both places, and I want to continue life in both places. It allows me to change things up, which is really refreshing. And Javi and I are actually looking at Bierzo right now, which is, I don't know if you know Bierzo, but yeah. Bierzo is an appellation, or Bierzo is an appellation way out towards Galicia. It is a cool in many senses. It grows, the grape there is Mencia, which is as close as you get to Pinot Noir without being Pinot Noir. And I'm excited to play with that. So, because, obviously I'm not going to be making wine at Sea Smoke. Chris has got that under control. But mm-hmm. I would love to play with something like Pinot Noir.
What about playing with Pep here, Pinot Noir in Santa Rita?
Contractually, we are not allowed to make Pinot Noir outside it. You know, Bob has been very generous in allowing us to have our own projects. Chris has her wine called Curran.
Mm-hmm.
She makes a Grenache Blanc, which rocks. She makes a Syrah and a Sangiovese at the moment. And then I've got my wine in Spain. But Bob was really clear that it won't be Pinot Noir outside of, you know, Sea Smoke.
Yeah.
But Bierzo is things are happening there. Alvaro Palacios is there doing some really interesting things. And so we're looking right now.
the three different Pinots that you make,
okay.
Favorite pairings with each of those, and then are there any other, or what are some of your favorite standout winemakers also in this appellation?
Okay. I'm not the best person to ask about pairings, being the vegetarian that I am.
Oh, okay.
Sorry to hear about that.
Well, the pescatarian. I make exceptions for shellfish. But so what I pair, and Southing is actually my favorite of these three, in case I didn't give that away earlier. But what I like to eat with these wines tend to be mushroom risottos, like Morels or something, you know, that's really savory. These wines are beautiful with those. I can tell you, having in my past lives been a sommelier and other things, that, you know, they pair really, really well with light game meats, like duck. They rock.
Fatty.
Yeah. But I tend to pair them with, you know, savory pasta and mushroom and risotto dishes, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was really surprised at, I think it was 03 vintage out at Sanford. This was a winemaker's technical, kind of a technical symposium. We get together and taste each other's wines. And in those days, I was still invited. And we tasted, I think, I don't know, 30-something wines from the appellation. And there were maybe, and this is among winemakers, so you're allowed to say what the dog wines are. You know, because people are bringing things that have potential problems or what have you. There were 2 dog wines out of 30-something wines. I mean, that blew me away. I had only been here for, you know, a couple years, and I was just floored that there could be that many wines that were really, really good, and not technically flawed, you know, just really, really pretty wines. So the region speaks.
Right.
Is the reality. The region speaks. And you got to really screw things up. You know, to not have the fruit speak here. That's the luck of this appellation. It's just, it's amazing. And so there are a variety of people all over the board making wines in a variety of different styles. Brewer Clifton, you know, Greg's making stuff with stem inclusion that is that old world style that are, and, you know, he's getting the scores to match. He's doing amazing stuff. And then there, you know, we're on kind of the, along with Brian Loring, are probably on the other end of that spectrum of deeper, richer, no stem character at all. And there are people who fall, you know, that's just one, using one parameter, meaning stem inclusion. But there are wine, there are expressions of Santa Rita Hills across the gamut. And a lot of people are making really good wines. You know, Foley, with a big property, is making really nice wines. Ampelos is making really nice wines. They're on Mail Road. We passed them going to Sea Smoke. And Don's family, our assistant winemaker, actually owns that winery. And Deerberg, that new development as you came to the end of Mail Road, they're doing really pretty Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. And that's a new project, their new planting.
What year was it when the appellation became? You know, when they granted it, they recognized it.
You know, I wasn't here then. If I remember correctly, the actual recognition came in 01 or 02, the final paperwork may have been 01. But Richard would be the person to ask. I mean, he was, you know, the sort of driving force behind that. And now he's got his own project. And it's kind of early to say, because I haven't tasted all those wines, but that vineyard, La Encantada Vineyard, that he's making wine off, and Bruno's making wine off for Badge, is a killer vineyard. That whole old Rancho Lavinia vineyard is, which you saw from Sea Smoke, you know, off down and to the right. You know, pretty much every, there just aren't dog wines in the appellation.
Well, pretty much everybody's recognizing it. I mean, you can't pick up a trade pub or even wine shops. Neil and I know a couple of people that own wine shops. They're selling just on the appellation.
Yeah,
I mean, they're selling Pinot Noir, Santa Rita Hills, regardless of who.
And I hope it continues. I mean, we're at an interesting moment in the development. You know, putting on my Santa Rita Hills Wine Growers Alliance hat for the moment, we're in an interesting transition in this appellation. I really hope, you know, we don't have the luxury in this country of the appellation system and sort of the safeguards that are built into an appellation system. Because ours is just, oh, you apply to the government, yes, you can put that on your label, but there's no quality control parameters involved. And probably appropriately so. This is America. We don't over-control things. But the dark side of that is that there are going to be people who are going to come in and ride on this Appalachian and crank out tonnage. And what are you going to do? You know, the Appalachian's going to go through growing pains.
So touch base quickly on the Chardonnay. Even though Sea Smoke is Pinot, Pinot is Sea Smoke, you do make Chardonnay, so you have to talk about it just a little bit.
We do make Chardonnay. Given what we've discussed, you, I'm sure, know we wouldn't do it if we weren't going to do it right, even though we give most of it away. It's grown the same way. It's on deeper soils, which would be inappropriate for Pinot Noir. We use primarily Wente Cologne. We're selling the other 769596 to Brewer Clifton, and they're making a pretty wine out of that. And we decided we really wanted to focus on Wente. And so we keep that, and all barrel fermented, all 100% French new cooperage, and aged about the same time as Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we bottle either, depending upon bottling schedule, but we give most of it away to charity events and to list members. If they order their full allocation, it just shows up as a thank you for doing business with us. Thanks for supporting us in your case. And then we give to restaurants and retailer, you know, fine wine shops that have supported us. They will just get a bottle hand delivered with a caveat that they not resell it, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called gratis. And then a small amount of the same Chardonnay under a different label, because it's not free, is sold in magnums only to the upper portions, meaning people with the most points on our list. And, you know, we took great pains early on. The biggest complaint I heard from people about lists, mailing lists or what have you in wineries, is they seemed like a black box where somebody was sitting behind the curtain, you know, making decisions and passing out, you know, favors to the humble masses, and that any movie star or somebody could walk up and get whatever they wanted at any time. Well, that doesn't happen here. You know, Virginia Madsen showed up couple months ago and said, hey, do you guys have any wine? And, you know, the reality is I would have had to have given away somebody's allocation to give her wine. And I said, you know, sorry. You know, she was totally cool. She's like, I understand. No problem. I'll get on the list. You know, my mom can't get any more wine. It's just, it's point-based. So what we decided to do was open up that black box and let you see inside of it and say, here's how the allocations are determined. Here's the points. Here's how you get points. And it's not just dollars. People you refer, years on the list, and so it's all transparent. So you know, you don't feel like you're getting the runaround. And you know, we've heard positives and negatives about that for sure. Over the years. But
how large is the mailing list then?
Large. Actually, in April we're instituting a waiting list. Up to this point, we hadn't had to do that.
But mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point now.
So, anytime soon, any screw caps be on any Sea Smoke wines? And if not, what are your thoughts about that?
If we did it, it would be on Botella. And I don't see it in the near future. The jury is still out from my perspective on that. I know that there is one study out there that everybody trumps about long-term cellaring under screw cap, but I'm seeing odd things out there. And my comfort level is just not high enough.
Odd things such as?
With sulfite issues, you know. You've probably read the same things I have. I mean, I just think it's a little too early to bet the bank on it. And, you know, yes, the odd thing is we are an industry that relies on 3% unsellables. If it all came back, you know, no other industry, to be fair, would have that error rate acceptable. Just wouldn't occur. So I get the joke. I understand why people want to explore a screw cap. But it's a big step. I think people minimize it, the risk involved, particularly for wines that are going to be cellared.
Yeah.
If all these wines were going to be consumed within a couple of months, I wouldn't worry for a moment. You know, but a significant portion of our wines are purchased by collectors, and they're laid down. And that causes me more concern.
So when you talk about that cellaring, so what are your recommendations for cellaring each of the Botella, 10, and Sauvignon?
It seems the opinions on that are vary pretty dramatically.
And it also probably varies by vintage, too.
Well, to some degree, but, you know, this is California. It's not like Europe, where we have a bad vintage, one in 10 years, one in down here, particularly in Central Coast, Southern California. The bad vintages don't occur that often. I would argue that there's more variation to be seen in a young vineyard from the maturing of the vineyard than from the vintage to vintage variation from the weather often. Botella is probably, though Mr. Parker thinks that they're very ageable, and I trust to some degree his judgment, we don't know because we're a fairly young winery. We can guess based on acid levels and tannin structure and everything else that they're going to be fine, but I can tell you our 01 Botella, if you have it, drink it. You know, and as you said, like our first vintages are a different thing because that was young fruit. And, you know, although they were lovely, lovely wines out the gate, the question is their long-term ageability. As you go up, Southing and 10, the structure of those wines are going to allow for greater aging for sure.
So do you prefer that personally?
For people to age them?
For you personally.
I like to drink these wines after they've been in bottle a year at least, and then to give them really adequate decanting.
Half an hour to an hour,
yeah, for sure. And they show so much better. And you know, one of the biggest mistakes people make with Pinot Noir, and we made those mistakes, is traveling with them and then opening, particularly around the holidays. Pinot Noir, for whatever reason, there's anecdotal evidence for this. I can't give you a technical explanation, but I know from experience, every time we fly with these wines and we pour them, we're sorely disappointed. So what we do now is we send wines 2 to 3 weeks ahead, mm-hmm. and we let them sit in the, you know, send them up to Tom, a friend, and let them sit. I don't know. All I know is actual experience.
Winemaker dinners across the nation, you
exactly.
send them wine early.
Yeah, or, meeting with press appointments or what have you. You know, it's just we have to do it.
Yeah.
I have never not been disappointed when I've flown with these
wines.
And
then whenever you're pouring the wine, do you prefer to decant all the time?
If I have the option,
yeah,
because unless it's an old vintage, now that we have some library wine that we can drink, that may be, you know, we'll see. But it just, even in that case, for these wines, definitely. Botella, not so much. Botella you can pop and it's usually fine.
Yeah.
Victor, we know that with all your work at Sea Smoke and your project in Spain, that you're very, very busy. So we appreciate you letting us stop by, spending all this time talking with us, and for the 05 Botella.
My pleasure.
So thank you.
Cheers.